Good evening and welcome to the local news. Today is Tuesday, February 24th. I'm Lisa Music reporting for KMUD. In tonight's news, Blue Lake Way's battery storage proposal amid community concerns. Humboldt cannabis permit revocations loom, and interim president Spagna discusses campus climate and free speech at Cal Poly Humboldt. Stay tuned. News on those stories and more coming right up. The Blue Lake City Council is weighing a big decision that could change the future of the city's old, defunct power plant. The council held a special meeting last Thursday, and according to Sage Alexander of the Times-Standard, they got an update on a deal with Power Transitions, a Houston-based company that repurposes old energy sites for renewable power projects. Power Transitions wants to turn parts of the plant into a 20-megawatt battery energy storage system, or BESS. Essentially, this facility would store extra electricity and send it back to the grid when demand spikes. Their plan includes demolishing parts of the old plant while keeping some existing infrastructure to make the project work. The company is looking to buy 2 acres of city-owned land and lease 4 more, but the deal hinges on them handling demolition costs themselves. Timing is tight. Pacific Gas and Electric has limited windows for connecting projects like this to the grid, with the next opportunity coming up in March. That's why the council is considering a 2-year option agreement, which would give Power Transitions the right to the land. A final decision is expected by or before March 10th. The proposal sparked mixed reactions among council members. Some, like Kat Napier and Chris Fuhrer, saw the phased approach as a reasonable compromise. Others, including Mayor Pro Tem Elise Scafani, were wary about how fast things are moving and raised concerns about transparency in the negotiations. Scafani also wanted input from Redwood Coast Energy Authority, or RCEA, a local agency focused on renewable energy solutions. RCEA later clarified to KMUN News that it's open to energy storage projects across Humboldt County, but hasn't prioritized the Blue Lake site. While RCEA does have an agreement with the city to explore options for the old plant, it stressed that no specific developer was ever chosen. The agency also made it clear that it doesn't engage with individual developers or speculate on which projects might get approved. That said, the Blue Lake site does have some advantages. RCEA pointed out that because it already has grid infrastructure in place, it would be cheaper and quicker to use compared to undeveloped locations. But even with those benefits, there's no guarantee that RCEA will back the project. Community reaction has been strong. More than 100 people attended a town hall on Sunday, and most were opposed to the best plan. A petition against the project launched by local resident Terry Bales has already gathered 141 signatures. Opponents have raised several concerns. The facility would be located near the Blue Lake Levee, which has a history of breaches, including in 1955 and 1964. A major flood could lead to dangerous water intrusion and potential fires. While lithium-ion phosphate batteries are more stable than other types, they still carry risks of overheating or electrical faults that could lead to fires. The site is also upstream from the Mad River Pump Station, which provides drinking water to over 46,000 Humboldt County residents in Blue Lake, Eureka, and Arcata. And a fire or flood-related contamination could be disastrous. Economically, critics argue that Blue Lake wouldn't see much benefit, as the stored electricity wouldn't be used locally. They also worry about lower property values, higher insurance costs, and negative effects on tourism. Additionally, concerns have been raised about the potential for noise pollution from the cooling systems and the impact of bright floodlights and high-voltage equipment on the town's aesthetic. On the other side, supporters see this as a step towards renewable energy and a more stable power grid. California has been expanding BESS projects to help prevent blackouts and better integrate solar and wind energy. If done right, storage facilities like this can reduce reliance on fossil fuels and improve energy resilience during outages. Economically, the project could be a win for Blue Lake. The city wouldn't have to pay to tear down the deteriorating power plant, and leasing land to power transitions could bring in extra revenue. Former Mayor Adeline Jones even called the old plant an attractive nuisance, noting that it has become a safety hazard. There was even a recent electrocution incident on the site. The Blue Lake City Council is set to discuss the best proposal again tonight, Tuesday, February 25th, at 6:30 p.m. The meeting will take place at the Skinner store located at 111 Greenwood Road in Blue Lake. For a link to the meeting, visit kmud.org. Stay tuned as we continue to cover this high-stakes energy debate. Cannabis permits in Humboldt County are up for revocation due to non-payment of Measure S taxes. Daniel Mintz reports.
Humboldt County's enforcement of the Measure S cannabis excise tax is about to advance with a series of permit revocations beginning next month. Farmers with back tax debts had until March 31, 2024, to enter into payment plans with the county. Almost a year later, the county is proceeding with the consequences of not doing so, revoking cannabis permits. Planning Director John Ford explained the situation during an update at the February 20th Humboldt County Planning Commission meeting.
We have started a process where people who have not been paying their Measure S taxes and did not enter into an agreement to pay their taxes and owe the department money. These are folks that absolutely did not enter into a payment agreement with the treasurer tax collector. We're starting to take those forward for revocation. 22 of those are going forward on March 11th.
When you say those go forward, those go to the Board of Supervisors?
Board of Supervisors alone have the ability to revoke.
Can they still have time to negotiate a payment plan if they're interested in that, or is that time up?
That time was actually up March 31st of 2024.
Commissioner Thomas Mulder noted that those with tax debts could pay the county $100 to kick off a payment plan, and quote, "that's all it took to stay off this list." Ford said another, ultimately final, Measure S deadline is coming up.
There is another pending deadline that is causing great angst in the cannabis community, which is that the board ask that farmers finish, pay off their balance for their processing, and then enter into the agreement by March 31st of 2024 to pay their balances on their Measure S taxes by March 31st of 2025. That March 31st date is coming up, and so we will be taking an item forward to the board to ask them what they want to do with facts that exist. There's unfortunately a good number that haven't done too much to beyond paying the $100. And so we're going to be looking at options of what the board can do in response.
The county suspended Measure S taxes for the 2025 cultivation year, which follows a 90% reduction of the tax in 2024 and a two-year suspension prior to that. Last November, planning staff told supervisors the total Measure S tax debt to the county stood at about $12 million. In another report, Ford told commissioners almost a year after Humboldt County's short-term rental STR ordinance went into effect, hundreds of units remain unpermitted. He said only 201 applications for permits have been received. Of those, 137 have been approved. When Ford said there are 600 to 700 STRs operating in the county, commissioners were surprised and asked about potential for enforcement. But Ford said there's a procedural reason for many of the non-applications.
Part of the reason that we don't have more is that a lot of them will be in the coastal zone. Uh-huh. And the Coastal Commission has not certified our document yet. So there's that part of it. The economy may have cooled down a little bit too from where it was. And so I think that that's probably part of it. We typically, from a code enforcement perspective, don't do proactive enforcement. Mm-hmm. We typically are complaint-based. Cannabis was an exception. Part of that was because people were completely disregarding the laws, cutting holes in the forest and grading the tops off of hills. And so that needed to stop.
Asked when the coastal version of the STR ordinance will be certified by the state, Ford said he's not expecting it, quote, much before the end of this year. The meeting's consent agenda of routine items included permits for three existing cannabis farms. Approved without discussion were conditional use permits for cultivation areas ranging from 20,000 to 28,500 square feet in size in Alder Point, Salmon Creek, and Willow Creek. In Eureka for KMUD News, this is Daniel Mentz.
Some permit holders are saying that they are being erroneously charged for site visits or have not received bills. Stay tuned for additional coverage on cannabis permit billing issues. Cal Poly Humboldt has announced that it will name its new acting president at the end of March, following the resignation of former president Tom Jackson Jr., who stepped down in the summer of 2024. Jackson served as Cal Poly Humboldt's president for 5 years and was the university's first Black, Filipino, and Native American president. However, his tenure was also marked by controversy, particularly after student-led anti-war protests and a campus occupation escalated into a massive law enforcement raid involving hundreds of officers. Jackson officially left his position in August 2024, and since then, the California State University system has been conducting a national search for a permanent president, with a final selection expected to be announced by the end of March 2025. In the interim, Michael Spagna has been serving as acting president. To better understand his role, the aftermath of Jackson's resignation, and the future of Cal Poly Humboldt, we spoke with him in this interview.
My name is Michael Spagna, and I've been in the Cal State University system for going on 33 years now. Originally trained as a teacher, I'm a former middle school teacher. My specialty is dyslexia and special education. Worked for many years in that field. And then I started at Cal State Northridge in 1991 as an assistant professor, eventually became a Eisner chair for the Center for Teaching and Learning, became a dean of education at Cal State Northridge. Then most recently, I was provost down at Cal State Dominguez Hills, down in Carson, California. And then recently, I was chosen in August to come to the campus as the interim president at Cal Poly Humboldt. And it's been my pleasure and honor to have joined the community here in Humboldt.
It has been nearly a year since students barricaded themselves inside Siemens Hall while hundreds more gathered in the UC Quad to protest the war in Gaza and demand that the university divest from Israeli-affiliated organizations. With protests and unrest now seemingly quieting down, we asked the acting president about the current campus climate in the aftermath of these events.
Actually, I think all of us in higher education experienced a lot of disruption in climate in the spring. So this affected us nationally. It affected us within the Cal State system at differential levels. I'll say at Cal Poly Humboldt, I'd say that it was a pretty serious thing that happened here in terms of protests. And I think there's a lot of healing that had to happen on the other side of that protest in April. And so when you say that the campus climate's been a little quieter, I think it's more about getting back to our mission at the California State University, which is really we're all about education. We're about supporting young people, our students, coming through, making sure that they are assertive advocates. We often say to students, we want you to be the change you want to see in the world, but that requires an educational component. And so one of the things we really focused on campus in order to heal and promote our mission is to really scaffold and make sure we have supports, particularly for students that are trying to find their voice, that are trying to engage in free speech, that are trying to be transformed in terms of their education. So although you characterize it as it's kind of quiet right now, I think we're actually serving our mission. And we've stood up several structures at the university that are helping students be able to meet those goals of finding their voice and being able to be in community. So we have a free speech support team that's been put in place to provide education and guidance in terms of what is free speech. We also have a community engagement team that we have been promoting that is led by faculty, staff, and students to be engaging students in their education. So quiet from my standpoint is that students are getting their degrees, they're studying, and they're also having opportunities to exercise free speech. And we've had activities in the fall, several vigils, several protests, and they have all gone the way that protests should. Students being able to express themselves in free speech, but being able to do it in a way that effectively they're able to fine tune it. So once they graduate with their degrees, they're going to be effective change agents out in the community.
Concerns have emerged over the intersection of anti-war sentiment and anti-Semitism. Last year, we spoke with a local rabbi who stated that the student protests were not anti-Semitic and that conflating the two was both harmful and irresponsible. The rabbi also pointed out that while the university condemned protesters in the name of protecting the Jewish community, it had previously ignored reports of actual threats against Jewish students. With these concerns in mind, we asked the acting president how the university differentiates between acceptable activism and harmful rhetoric, and what measures are in place to ensure the safety of all students, regardless of their ethnicity or religious beliefs.
Yes, well, I think that that's really, really important. And the differentiation you make, I fully embrace. And so one of the things I'll make sure you do is you get a copy of a communication that I put out. And this was at the end of October, which was entitled Empowerment Through Inclusivity, Transparency, and Communication. And it really, for me, it differentiates what you're talking about. And again, just to quote from this communication I sent out, let me quote from it. Let me be clear on this point. Hatred or discrimination in any form is antithetical to our core values. We unequivocally condemn acts of bigotry, violence, threats, or behaviors that harm our fellow human beings and tear at the bonds of this community that we share. This includes verbal or physical attacks on anyone based on their religious identity, ethnicity, gender, cultural practices, or political views. While the university can direct resources and support the harmed individuals, it takes all of us to reinforce our vision of a community where such acts are prevented. The idea here is that, especially coming out of COVID, students are in places now where they're seeing some pretty awful things happening in the world. And so one of the things we want to try and do is make sure that they're able to express themselves as they encounter these and they try and navigate them. However, what is out of bounds are any personal attacks against fellow human beings, as I said in that communication, against students, against faculty, against administrators, against staff. So that's something that we are very vigilant about. And particularly as you were talking about Jewish students, I've been in consultation with several rabbis in the community, spiritual leaders, about what can we do to ensure a safe, healthy environment for our students. And also, you might want to look at one of the things the system has set up is a universal time, place, manner policy. People talk about this a lot, but it talks about the boundaries of what is in bounds for free speech, what's out of bounds for free speech. And I think it's important for everybody to familiarize themselves with what those boundaries are. And we are making sure that we are observing those boundaries. For instance, one of the things we have is we have public areas where we allow free speech and we allow spontaneous protesting. We have other limited spaces and then we have non-public spaces. We also have times in terms of when you can have public protests and so forth on the campus. So these things are more to guide, serve as guidelines for students as they express themselves. But as you brought up, we're being very careful to make sure we're monitoring our environment. So again, it's a healthy learning environment for all. And once it impacts an ability for a student to feel that they're being threatened or they're in places where they can engage in healthy learning, that's something where we're going to intervene. And we'll be very direct about that.
Looking back, we ask how the situation, particularly the campus and law enforcement response to the protests, which escalated after more than a week, could have been handled differently by all parties involved. Additionally, what new protocols have been implemented to ensure that similar situations are managed more effectively in the future?
I'll restrict my comments to my observations. Again, I joined the campus on the first day of instruction on August 26th. I've been spending a lot of time with the community here at the university and the community external to the university talking about the events of April. And one of the things that I think all of us can learn from are the notions of what different choices were made at the time, what were the consequences of some of those choices. I don't think anybody in the entire community was pleased with the outcomes of what happened in April. So there is a lot of discussion about continuous improvement, reflections, conversations about what happened, and most importantly, what's action planning that we need to do going forward. I will tell you the thing that I really embrace about Cal Poly Humboldt is this has always been a university of activism. Historically, there has been activism through generations at this university. I recently was able to honor the class of 1975 that in a previous generation had been protesting the Vietnam War. So the change here that happened in April was that when that protest happened, it disrupted the university environment. It disrupted our mission of being able to confer degrees. And when that happens and when commencements are disrupted and classes are disrupted and athletics are disrupted, no one feels good about that. So the reflections we've been doing, and we're starting with professionally facilitated conversations, are what were reflections? What were lessons learned? What are things we want to make sure we do differently going forward? And I'm satisfied that this community has the intention of doing that. And my job is to help guide that conversation so we can get back to where we were before April, which is, again, a campus of activism, of free speech, but in a place where we don't disrupt the mission of the university. And last thing I'll say is that, again, first and foremost, what's our job? Our job is educating students and conferring degrees. And so what we always have to remind ourselves about is that that's our primary mission. So what are we doing to provide that education? And it's not just education in the classroom. In the classroom, we do things and teach disciplines that wind up giving competencies and knowledge and skills for people to get degrees. But it's also important, what do we do outside of the classroom? And how do we educate students and develop critical thinking and the ability to change your mind and to be able to have discourse with each other, even with those you disagree with? But at the same time, you have an elevated sense of self and an elevated sense of the issue. And I think that we're getting back to that. And I think the university is being reminded, all of our community, about the importance each of us plays in that mission.
We were just speaking with Michael Spagna, the appointed acting president of Cal Poly Humboldt. The California State University system continues its national search for a permanent president, with a final selection expected to be announced by the end of March 2025.
I want to tell you, my overwhelming sense here is that everyone wants this university and community to win. Everyone I've met, from previous generations of alums to current faculty to current staff to students that have graduated 50 years ago versus students that are in the pipeline right now, everyone wants this university to be all that it can be. And my job is to make sure we stay on that trajectory. We're in a very exciting inflection point. There are only 3 Cal Polys in the entire Cal State system. I'm very proud to say that it's wonderful to be at a university that's in this inflection point of a conversion from Humboldt State University to Cal Poly Humboldt. And it's my honor to be here as we do that inflection point. And so the best days are yet to come for this university. It's over 100 years old. I'm looking forward to setting the trajectory along with the new president that'll be chosen in March for keeping us on that trajectory. The economy needs it. The community needs it. The state needs it. And obviously, our nation needs really strong institutions of public education that can keep our society moving forward. So I'd end on that note. And I'm very optimistic and very excited about being here at Cal Poly Humboldt.
Special thanks to Lauren Schmidt for the production of this news story. In state news, CDFW to hold annual salmon information meeting. Lauren Schmidt reports.
The California Department of Fish and Wildlife will host its annual salmon information meeting via webinar tomorrow, Wednesday, February 26th at 10 a.m. The event will cover spawning escapement, ocean abundance forecasts, and management objectives for the 2025 salmon season. The meeting also kicks off a 2-month public process to shape sport and commercial ocean fishing regulations. To learn more, we spoke with Emma Keller with CDFW's Marine Region.
Yeah, so the meeting is our annual salmon information meeting webinar. We will be talking about 2024 escapement numbers from the Central Valley and Klamath Basin. The National Marine Fisheries Service will be presenting on ocean abundance forecasts for 2025 and management goals for 2025. So there is when we'll get a good idea of what our salmon numbers are looking like based off of our escapement data. And yeah, the future of salmon fisheries, obviously we want a healthy, sustainable salmon fishery, but we've received preliminary data that suggests that our escapement numbers are pretty low, pretty on par to last year. So, but we will know for sure at our salmon information meeting webinar.
Northern California's salmon populations have been in steady decline due to habitat loss, climate change, and water management issues. This decline isn't just affecting the species. It is also having a major impact on commercial and recreational fisheries. Fishing restrictions and season closures have been implemented to protect dwindling stocks, leading to economic hardships for fishing communities, charter operations, and seafood industries. As conservation efforts continue, stakeholders are working to balance species recovery with the livelihoods that depend on salmon fishing.
Yeah, so our ocean salmon fishery has been closed for the past 2 years. The last time it was closed was in 08 and 09, so it's been quite a while since the salmon fishery has been closed. That's based off our low escapement numbers and low ocean abundance forecast numbers. There is really a variety of factors that contribute to salmon abundance, but one major factor is drought. And it has to do with, you know, how conditions were 3 years prior, because that is the age that salmon migrate back to their rivers of origin. And it was a drought year 3 years ago. But we don't exactly know why we ocean salmon abundance numbers are so low. There's so many factors at play, but yeah, we understand how impactful this is to people who depend on salmon for their livelihood and recreational and commercial ocean salmon anglers.
Tomorrow's virtual salmon information meeting is the beginning of a public process on how fishing seasons are decided.
Yeah, so we are in the pre-season process right now. There will be an opportunity for Q&A at the salmon information meeting webinar, and there will be an opportunity for public comment. We will have a survey at the end of our meeting, and then we'll be headed off to the Pacific Fishery Management Council meetings, where there will also be an opportunity for public comment during the March meeting, which is March 5th through the 11th. And that is the meeting that determines whether or not ocean salmon fisheries are open prior to May 16th. There's also a few Fish and Game Commission meetings that are happening where there's opportunity for public feedback, and all of that information is posted on our preseason website page.
KMI News asked Keller if she could provide any insight into the current stance of officials on whether a salmon season will take place this year or if it will face a third consecutive closure.
There's no real insight. We're just really collecting. We're just dealing with the data right now. And the data will be analyzed at the Pacific Fishery Management Council meetings by the salmon technical team, which creates this document called the 2024 Review of Ocean Salmon Fisheries, which will be posted to their website, which will have all the escapement data. So it's a process that is decided between all these different advisory bodies, state, federal, tribal, industry, ocean recreational anglers, general public, and anyone who has an interest in the salmon fishery. But we don't know yet. There may be a chance for small fishing opportunity, but we can't say for sure. Last year, there were regulatory alternatives that were crafted, that one of the regulatory alternatives was to have the salmon fishery open for a few days. So there may be something similar to that happening this year, but we can't say for sure.
Tomorrow's annual salmon information meeting will take place online and will cover the 2024 spawner abundances returning to the Central Valley and Klamath basins, 2025 abundance forecasts, and management context guiding the development and implementation of the 2025 ocean salmon fisheries. The public is invited to attend. The meeting will be hosted as a webinar only, and its link will be posted Tuesday morning at wildlife.ca.gov. KMA News will share the link to the agenda on our website at kmud.org. Reporting for Redwood Community Radio, I'm Lauren Schmidt.